Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to talk to you about an issue that has been with us for a very long time. We're talking about police brutality, police terrorism, and police undermining social and political movements. We hear people talk about that, but it's often kind of just trite. It's like we say it and we keep moving it on. So joining us this afternoon is a professor of history, University of Baltimore, prolific writer, and somebody who did his due diligence in adding more complexity and more insight to the civil rights movement. His name is Joshua Davis, and he wrote a very compelling book that is called Police Against the Movement: The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back. And initially, when I heard about the book, I thought, okay, yeah, police brutality has been with us forever. And we all heard the saying, the origins of the police were that they were slave patrols. So, of course, they would undermine social movements. But to read about it in detail, to demystify some of the images that we've heard or we've seen, in particular during the heyday of Dr. King and SNCC and others. Police brutality, when I think about it, was kind of just something along the side. You heard a little bit about it, but it was really about how can we segregate these counters? How can we segregate desegregate these schools? How can we get voting rights passed? And if we did hear about law enforcement, it was often about J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI in COINTELPRO. This book, I had no idea that the police were much more strident, probably had the blueprint more than the FBI in terms of surveillance, and was a force that was continuously trying to undermine the civil rights movement in a variety of ways, which we get to talk about. And the other thing that I really think is important about this book that our guest wrote is that he talks about the resistance. And we'll get into that, but folks just didn't take it on the chin. And I think after reading this book, anybody who says, I'm not your grandfather or grandmother's civil rights movement is woefully uninformed, because reading about some of the battles that these individuals took, it was very impressive and something that we need to take note. So, Joshua Davis, welcome to the show. I gave a little synopsis, but we can go a lot deeper. But talk to us a little bit about the book. What led you to want to write this, and how did you get a lot of this information when I think we've seen every documentary that you could think of, Eye on the Prize. We read all the books. We've seen the Deacons of Defense. That might have been the closest we've seen to armed resistance. We just had, the folks behind Maple and the Williams, where they talked about we will shoot back. But here, this is a whole other chapter in the civil rights struggle, taking us all the way up to the Black Lives Matter movements.
And thanks first of all, Davey, for having me on the show. So, the book is called Police Against the Movement: The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back. I started writing this book around 2017. You referenced the Black Lives Matter movement that was very much on the rise at that time and was getting a lot of media coverage. And one thing that I was noticing was that how much of the media coverage was describing BLM as the new civil rights movement. It's where the past civil rights movement ended and where the new movement begins. It was a movement that was picking up unfinished work and over again. And this is not how BLM was talking about themselves. This was how media was talking about BLM and saying they're doing something the civil rights movement did not do, could not do, would not do. And so that really raised a question for me. I said, I wonder what the civil rights movement of the 1960s actually did about police violence. I think, as we all know, there are these iconic, horrific moments of police violence that are some of the, most unforgettable moments of the civil rights movement. It's the Birmingham police and Bull Connor attacking black children with fire hoses and attack dogs. It's folks trying to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. And you know, those come on any documentary. And the message is always, this is what happened to the civil rights movement. They were victimized. They suffered this violence. Thank God they were able to transcend and persevere as a nonviolent, almost saints of the movement. And I'm not diminishing the fact that there was perseverance, transcendence, and nonviolent resistance at all. But what I learned in my research pretty quickly was, okay, wow, the civil rights movement of the 60s actually resisted police violence a lot more than we give them credit for. And this is, you know, even before the Black Panther Party, who, you know, brilliantly made fighting police violence a centerpiece of their program. But it's looking at groups like SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, looking at CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, the more radical parts of the movement, and seeing, okay, they were picketing at police stations. They were literally doing sit-ins sometimes in police stations. They were shutting down bridges and roads. And it wasn't just physical brutality they were talking about. They were also talking about all kinds of false arrests. And by the end of the 60s, they're talking about things like surveillance and infiltration. And again, this is stuff being done by local police, right? Like you said, we're very aware of the FBI, COINTELPRO, those things. But part of this book was really saying, hey, it's not just the feds, it's not just Hoover, it was local police departments all over the country that were trying to disrupt and sabotage the civil rights movement. And we need to give this movement credit again that it was doing a lot of work against police violence that we have forgotten about.
Yeah, it's definitely a walk through memory lane. It's a very important history. So let's start off. You talk about in the book the Communist Party and the police surveillance around that. And in fact, you start off with I guess the chapter is called Political Police. You know, who are the political police? The Red Squads, the intersection between black folks and the Communist Party. Because that's where, you know, the brutality of the police, but them honing their game for surveillance, is something that I think very few people knew about. They were on a mission, both in the South and in the North, all around, you know.
Exactly. Excellent question. As you said, this is a book about the South, North, East, and West. It is a national story of police all over the country trying to disrupt the civil rights movement. You brought up the Red Squads. They're pretty forgotten today. What they were basically were secretive political intelligence units. Virtually every big city police department in the country had one. Chicago had one, New York had one, San Francisco had one, LA had one. You might think of them as little FBIs almost. And they were doing a lot of this work we think of as, you know, disruption, infiltration, you know, even before the so-called COINTELPRO initiative against so-called black extremists, which was launched in 1967. But these Red Squads were doing surveillance. They were amassing huge file cabinets, dossiers on anyone who was involved in political movements. I mean, literally millions of files. They were going to rallies. They were taking down names, taking down license plates. They were doing press clippings. And yes, sometimes they were even dispatching officers to infiltrate activist groups, to take on the role of fake activists. You brought up the communists, you know. We have to give the Communist Party credit going back to the 20s and 30s for identifying, I guess, what we would call political policing. Like you said, all policing is political. There's no such thing as non-political policing. But I use the term political policing in terms of active policing against political activists, right? When the police are explicitly trying to undermine, stop, block, sabotage political activists. And these Red Squads got their names because they went after communists, they went after Reds. And going back to the 30s, communists are writing about them. They are, raising the alarm against these Red Squads. Someone who really captivated me was this guy named Ben Davis. He's very forgotten today. Ben Davis was, I think, one of two or three communists who were ever elected to public office in the United States. He was a city councilman from New York City. He represented Harlem. He was a black man who grew up in Atlanta. And police brutality is like one of his signature issues. I mean, really, it was his key issue. And this goes back to days in Atlanta when Atlanta's police was going after black folks, shooting and killing them, and trying to go after communists who were raising protests around that. Ben Davis got a start from there, and then he later moved to New York. He became a city councilman. He wrote a lot about police brutality. He even created this pamphlet called Lynching Northern Style that was about police brutality in New York. And he later was taken out by the Red Scare in one of these big federal trials. And he was, convicted under the Federal Smith Act of crimes related to being a member of the Communist Party and put in prison. And he later got out, but, he paid a dear, dear price for his activism.
As I was reading, and I know you said you started writing this book in 2017. So I'm not sure if you saw the handwriting on the wall or you could imagine that we would be at this moment that we're at now with a very aggressive ICE force. And I'm reading this, and I know that these Red Squads were going after communists. But let's substitute the word communist for Antifa. Let's substitute the word communist for immigrants or cartels or any other descriptor that this current administration has come up. Because what I'm reading is that people were caught up in the dragnet, whether they were involved or not. And the type of things that we're talking about now, where protest is pretty much criminalized. That was pretty much the case back then. Folks didn't have to be a member of the Communist Party to protest the police. And I want to make sure people are clear on that because we hear the word communist and it's like, well, Ben Davis, he deserved it and blah, blah, blah. But what I see is that that's just a pretense to start bashing on everybody. And you had these Red Squads that, under the pretense of finding communism, were disrupting and undermining any movements. And the key word is how these police were just undermining with, carte blanche. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because that's what I see the parallels today.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right to point that out. I mean, I think this goes beyond criticizing or demonizing activists. The playbook we're seeing the federal administration using right now, for example, where they are basically saying Antifa is domestic terrorists, right? I mean, that's literally the wording that a recent executive order describe them as. It is the criminalizing of activism and treating it as felonies, right? And so this is a playbook that, a lot of people remember, oh, this was happening in the Red Scare. It was used against communists. The thing that I think we don't remember as much is that that same playbook was used against the civil rights movement, not just to delegitimize because, oh, maybe Dr. King supposedly was linked to communists, but I mean literally to criminalize, and in particular to bring felony indictments against activists. These executive orders that the president is putting out there are trying to lay the groundwork for bringing felony cases against different Antifa groups, also groups aligned with Palestinian Solidarity. We're seeing it in the Stop Cop City movement in Atlanta from a few years ago, where a lot of those organizers still have state racketeering charges, basically Georgia level RICO charges hanging over their heads. We remember that civil rights activists.
And this is an important point to make because this is what was being done damn near 100 years ago, right? And
Yes.
I think what I found fascinating about the book, and I don't mean to cut you off, Joshua Davis, our guest, is when we say the civil rights, we think Emmett Till, on up. We think Montgomery bus boycott on up. But you're situating this before that, right? And I think people have to emphatically remember that there were Black freedom movements way before, Dr. King and them came along. We're from Marcus Garvey, who is subjected to this, to, W.E.B. Du Bois. All of these types of movements were very vigorous from the South to the North. And I think that's a forgotten chapter that we have, that people just didn't start fighting back in 1955, but they had been fighting back vigorously, and these police were there m alongside them every step of the way, undermining and doing some of the tactics that we're seeing play out today, but probably perfecting them back then.
For sure. And I wrote about the example of Ella Baker. A lot of your listeners may know her as in a sense, kind of the mother to SNCC. I mean, she was kind of the adult advisor to SNCC, which was the only national Black youth-led organization in the civil rights movement. And she had a very long history in organizing. She had been involved in the NAACP. She was not a communist or a socialist, but she was someone who was open to being in conversation with some of those folks. And what was really important to me is you mentioned the Montgomery bus boycott. That was 1955. Several years before that, she's heading up the New York chapter of the NAACP, and she basically makes it the chapter's focus for a year to try to fight police brutality at the hands of the NYPD, because the NYPD had a secret agreement with the FBI. Whenever someone complained formally about police brutality, if they sent it to the feds would just send it right back to the NYPD and say, "We don't need this." Ella Baker and her NAACP comrades discovered that, and they challenged the NYPD for months in a campaign. And the way the NYPD ended up beating that campaign back was by saying, "This all sounds very communist. You're trying to discredit the levers of government. You're trying to make our way of life look wrong in America. This is communist. This is subversive." And it got the national NAACP very nervous about any campaigns against police brutality. And Ms. Baker had to back away from it. NAACP, it's a whole other story, but they were very scared about being charged as communists. And they just said, "We don't want to mess with police brutality." But that issue will pop up again and again, especially from more radical activists than SNCC and CORE when they emerge in the 60s.
Before we get into the South, let's talk about the type of things that you were seeing that was taking place in northern cities. When you mentioned the Red Squad growing up in New York, they had a Purple Squad by the time I was a kid in the 70s. And that Purple Squad was going after quote unquote gangs, the Black Spades. If we talk about the origins of hip hop, one of the stories that we talk about is how Afrika Bambaataa's best friend, Sol Ski, is killed, Pelham Bay Parkway by this Purple Squad. And growing up, I remember people surrounding the police stations. So that was a resistance that I'm glad you highlight in the book, not this particular one, but young people resisting police the way that they did. They would surround the police stations and, were fearless. And it was those purple squads that were like visiting people in the aftermath. Like they had names, numbers, and they were a factor. So I guess my question is, I would imagine from reading the book, to me, I was like, oh, the Red Squads became the Purple Squads. In your mind, did the Red Squads become, say, the crash unit? Did the Red Squads become all these other iterations, police, jump out boys, and all these other things that we see? Or did they become even more sophisticated and more hidden, in terms of what they were doing?
I mean, it's a good question. I think, the Red Squads at their heart were intelligence units. The idea is they were supposed to collect information, and their stated rationale was, okay, we're going after organized crime like the mafia. We're going after high-level operators and, subversives, however you want to define that. And that political work really became their bread and butter, and surveilling and keeping tabs on and tracking and monitoring these subversives became their main work. And I think it's those tools of collecting intelligence that in later years police really deployed against gangs, like you mentioned, certainly in New York, in Chicago. And I think also increasingly used against, who police were accusing of selling drugs, and how this tool of surveillance and eavesdropping and phone tapping and, sound trucks and secret photography was really something that was heavily used against political activists. And then in the late 60s and in the 70s, being used more against so-called gang members, so-called rioters, right? The people who supposedly were burning down cities. And, the thing these all groups also have in common is these are elite units within police departments, right? These are not units. It's like police departments are saying, if you're political radicals, or if you are gangs, or if you're an organized crime, or if you're a high level, drug cartel, we're going to have to create a higher level of unit to go after you. And they are going to do a lot of detective work, literally. They're going to do a lot of intelligence, but also they are going to have increased or enhanced powers, right? They are going to, be allowed to do things that other beat officers are not allowed to do. And we're going to kind of celebrate them as these elite units to go after really so-called bad guys. And so, yeah, I think there's a direct through line there, like you're talking about, that we need to be aware of.
Joshua Davis, our guest, talking about the book, Police Against the Movement. You talked about surveillance, and nowadays surveillance seems kind of normalized, and we assume that everything's on the up and up. And hey, Josh and Dave, if you guys are members of the gang, police have to do what they want to do. But you point out a lot of this surveillance was actually illegal, and they eventually wound up destroying records and all that. Can we talk a little bit about that? That aspect of policing.
Yes. So what happened at the very end of the 60s, early 70s, is that a lot of these red squads were bringing major felony indictments against the Black Panthers, for example, and also some veterans of SNCC. And actually, there's a real interesting kind of connection between the Panthers and SNCC that we often forget about. They were even united as an organization for a few months in 1968. But basically, in places like New York and LA, major felony indictments brought against Panthers, where the NYPD said that 21 Panthers were trying to blow up police stations and trying to blow up department stores. And famously, one of the 21 they charged was Afeni Shakur, Tupac's mom. And they charged them with felonies and put them in jail for like over a year. And in the course of bringing these charges, the police had to start showing evidence of, all right, so how do you know this? And in the discovery process, that the lawyers who are defending the Panthers are very aggressive in using the discovery process to say, all right, put your money where your mouth is. NYPD, like, show us. You say you have an undercover operator in the Panthers. Well, show us. Who is it? What are the papers? And they started kind of, just pulling a few of these documents out of the NYPD through the discovery process. And as activists began to see these documents detailing surveillance in the early 70s in a number of cities, larger groups of activists, and not just Panthers, but also civil rights activists, veterans of SNCC, anti-war activists, started coming together in a number of cities and saying, we've got to sue our local police department because they are spying on us, and we've got to figure out how much they're doing, why they're doing it. There were litigation all over the country, New York, Chicago, Houston, Memphis, Detroit, and activists brought these big federal cases where they said police departments who spy on political activists are violating our First Amendment rights of free speech and free assembly. They are violating our Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable search and seizure. They brought really big constitutional cases against police departments. And in some cases, they won. They won a big one in Chicago in the mid-70s. In New York, it was a 14-year case filed in 1971 and not
Wow.
ruled on by 85. Yeah, 85. And they basically NYPD said, all right, we'll settle with you guys. But you've
What was the
alluded,
settlement?
the settlement was the NYPD said, we're going to stop spying on political activists. Unless there's
Okay.
evidence of criminal intent, we're not allowed to spy on political activists. And they have again and again over the years tried to renegotiate that settlement and sometimes have. So after 9/11, for example, the NYPD went back to that case and said, hey, we're being attacked by terrorists. We've got to kind of loosen some of the rules around surveillance because some of these so-called Muslim terrorists really, we've got to be able to get at them more easily, even though we said we would not surveil political activists unless they have demonstrated criminal intent. But you reference this also as like a lot of police departments told the world in the 70s, you know what we're going to do to fix this problem? We're sorry we did this. We're just going to destroy millions of records. In New York, they destroyed millions of records. In LA, Tom Bradley had a press conference and said, I'm happy to announce we're destroying over 2 million of the Red Squad records. And, at the time, they were trying to sell that as, hey, we're trying to prevent people from being humiliated and shamed in these files if they're released. But it was just not only a terrible act of harm against the historical record, but it destroyed lots of potential evidence that could have been used as the basis for, lawsuits if it had ever come out.
Joshua Davis, when we think of COINTELPRO with the FBI, we know part of what they did was look for things that they could compromise people with. I mean, there's the famous video where they're talking about we want to know your sexual habits and you want to know all these different types of things, right? And that would be used against, folks who were targets to COINTELPRO. Were the police, were the red squads with the local police, were they doing the same thing? So were they really just surveilling somebody to see if they had quote unquote communist connections, or were they trying to see, I guess if we're talking about the 60s and 70s, was this person gay? That would have been a big red flag and an embarrassment. Were they cheating on their wives? Those types of things that would serve to embarrass and really undermined somebody's credibility in a society that was very conscious of image at a at particular points in time.
Yeah, they were doing that, and I think humiliation was one of the tactics of political disruption. It's like you could ruin someone's reputation, you could get them fired from a job, you could have them kicked out of school. It's like all of these professional and social forms of punishment that may not raise to the level of criminal conviction or imprisonment are can be very, very harmful and just stop activists in their tracks. I mean, I think one of the things that some of these Red Squads did that we haven't fully acknowledged is that they, in some cases, infiltrated activist groups. So in New York, this guy named Ray Wood and another colleague of his named Gene Roberts, hired by the NYPD Red Squad in 1964, Gene Roberts went on to infiltrate Malcolm X's circle. Notoriously, he's seen kneeling over Malcolm X's body. If you've ever seen the terrible pictures of his murder, the Audubon Ballroom, he was supposed to be his bodyguard. I don't think probably that he was involved in the actual murder, but it is very strange that an NYPD officer.
He was a police officer, and I always point out to people, having been born across the street from the Audubon Ballroom. And I think it's something that folks need to go see for themselves. The Audubon Ballroom is like less than is less than a football. I mean, it's like it's not even a block. It's literally across the street from the emergency entrance to the Presbyterian Hospital is across the street. And the fact that you had Gene there, the police officer kneeling over the body, you had all these folks, and they weren't able to wheel Malcolm over, like 500 feet to the entrance of the hospital or have the hospital come to him speaks volumes that, in my opinion, police, which will lead to my other question, police were in on it. They wanted this to happen. You can't tell me otherwise because I've been to the Autobahn when they used to have hip hop parties there in the early days. And I remember we would always say, wow, this is where Malcolm was killed, right? And it's just a surreal thing. You look, it's like there's the entrance to the emergency right across the street. How did they not get Malcolm into that hospital? Why did it take 45 minutes? And when I learned that, police officers had infiltrated his organization, like, damn, y'all couldn't show your badges and say, we're taking him to the hospital. You were his bodyguard. It just angers me. I don't mean to go on a tangent, but it is so enraging when you kind of when you know that landscape.
And you know what's really remarkable is the same day that Gene Roberts was hired, the NYPD Red Squad hired this guy named Ray Wood, and Ray Wood infiltrated the Bronx chapter of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. That chapter had this guy named Herb Callender, who was really kind of leading up major protests against police brutality, not only in the Bronx, but in Manhattan. And it was really becoming embarrassing for the NYPD. This NYPD officer infiltrated his inner circle, befriended him, became an active member of Bronx CORE, and ended up talking Herb Callender into this totally ridiculous scheme of trying to perform a citizen's arrest on Mayor Robert Wagner. And the idea was, hey, citizen's arrest is a way to, catch this mayor because he's been using state funds to support discriminatory hiring practices. I mean, they had a basis for it, but it was just kind of ridiculous, the idea that it would actually work. And they had to notify the mayor about it in advance, and they told him, and they tried it at City Hall. And of course, the police stopped them in their tracks, arrested them. Herb Callender ended up being shipped off to Bellevue to the psych ward for like about a week. And,
Really?
And so the other thing I'll say quickly is this guy, Ray Wood. Then again, NYPD Red Squad says, there's even more dangerous guys out there. He becomes friends with three activists, Walter Bowe, Bob Collier, Khalil Syed. They maybe had this little group called the Black Liberation Front. He starts becoming friends with them and sells them on the idea of, what would be a really good protest? Let's blow up the Statue of Liberty. Let's dynamite it. And they're a little bit skeptical, but he says, hey, here's a book on how to build bombs. I got it from the army. And then he brings them gasoline. He says, you know what? There's some folks up in Canada who might be able to help us out with some dynamite. I got a car. Let's go up there. He drives one of them up to Canada. NYPD paid for it. All along the way, he is encouraging this, again, totally ridiculous scheme. They end up informing the FBI about this, and the FBI ends up bringing basically those three guys get arrested. Ray Wood is heralded as a national hero. He's on newspapers all over the country, front pages. They cover up his face so you can't see it. And those guys end up going to federal prison for a few years, and it looks like entrapment. I mean, it's like he is along the way encouraging this scheme. He admitted he did it on the federal record. And the judge decided, well, these guys would have done this even without that encouragement. Even though this guy got a car and drove people up to Canada to try to meet some, radicals who had dynamite, they didn't need that. And even though they didn't have like phones to even coordinate stuff, they didn't need that. And even though they didn't have money to buy dynamite, they didn't need that. And in all of those things, Ray Wood played this key role. And it's like he was the hero, and those guys went to prison. NYPD officer sent in to infiltrate that organization. It was a tiny little group, too.
Yeah, I'm going to skip around a little bit in the book because there's so many chapters that you have that are just brilliant. But you mentioned CORE. And when we talk about fighting police brutality, let's talk a little bit about some of these key organizations. You had already mentioned Ella Baker was one. I want to get into the heroism of Fred Shuttlesworth. I did not know he got down the way that he did. That's a real, that's a dynamic, chapter there. But Core, you describe as probably one of the best equipped organizations to deal with police brutality. And in many ways, we talk about SNCC and everybody else, and we kind of, Core is there, but we don't really go into their history. And you lay it out for us.
I think most of your listeners will know the main four civil rights organizations. NAACP, of course, was one. Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. King's organization, very famous. Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. They're the shock troops of the movement. They had so many incredible organizers, and some of whom, many of whom are still alive and active, and people I consider friends. I think that the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, is the one of the big four that is the most forgotten, the least remembered. If people bring it up today, it's basically because of the Freedom Rides. Oh yeah, they started the Freedom Rides. The thing that was really interesting to me to learn about CORE, they were a national membership organization. They had chapters all over the country. They were in the South, they were in the North, they were in the West. They were very close to the ground and very connected to Black urban communities in a way that I don't think any other civil rights organization was, really. And I think that's what they're hearing in 62, 63, 64. They're hearing lots of folks saying police brutality is like just out of control, and this is really something that is important to our community to stop. Then, folks like Bull Connor and the Birmingham cops are attacking Black children on national television. Pictures all over the front pages of newspapers. And I think a lot of CORE folks across the country say, hey, wait a minute. Maybe NBC wants to tell us this is a Birmingham problem or an Alabama problem, but no, this is an America problem. And, even if the cops in our backyard are a little more unwilling to be caught doing it on TV, they're doing stuff like this. CORE starts telling its chapters, hey, you guys start documenting police violence, start demanding meetings with police chiefs, start going to police stations, make this one of your big issues. And they even have this member of the National CORE staff, this guy named Alan Gartner, who writes this whole report where he says, yeah, we could talk about police violence, but we really should be talking about police malpractice. He's saying it's much bigger than that. These are repeated and various acts of police basically violating their professional code, and they're doing harm. Yeah, it's physical. People are getting bones broken, heads cracked, people are being killed sometimes. But let's also look at the trumped up felony indictments they're bringing against people. Let's look at the forced confessions. Let's look at the false arrests. Let's look at this whole range of what we can call slow violence, different legal weaponry that's being used against Black folks. And so CORE is just at the forefront of it. It's amazing. And New York is where they're really at the forefront. They're very out front and they're radical. And again, this is, several years before the emergence of the Black Panther Party, who, was brilliant and really just kind of radicalized so many people. I think one thing I tried to bring up in this book occasionally was the Panthers were just amazing. They also knew a good idea when they saw one, and they were looking and hearing about things that folks in SNCC were doing in LA or in CORE in Seattle. They were doing police patrols following the police around more than a year before the Panthers even got off the ground. So there's a bit of a legacy there that we haven't really acknowledged.
You mentioned the term slow violence, which I think is important. I was fascinated in reading the chapter about Lori Pritchard. I often talk about him as being the one guy who was very smug in being able to outthink Dr. King in the campaign they did in Albany. I'll let you explain what he did. But I did not realize the other side of it. Which you thought on Eyes on the Prize, you read about it, but this guy who was smiling and seemed to be, came across as somebody who studied history and read the books and understood and just was playing a chess match against Dr. King was pretty brutal because, while he was doing that, he was like, yeah, let me send these civil rights activists off to these other prisons where they were being brutalized. And so he kept his hands clean, but he was just as brutal, but also coming up with these new tactics that you described to, cripple and stifle these organizations. So let's talk about Lori Pritchard, who is seen as some sort of forward-thinking sheriff in the South, but was pretty damn brutal. He was a smooth pimp to the gorilla pimp,
Yeah, he was quite smart, to give him credit. I think Lori Pritchett was the chief of the Albany, Georgia police. It's 1962. CORE and also SNCC had had this, dramatic victory with the Freedom Rides in 1961. And a big part of how they won was, of course, they got national media attention for their cause. And what they also did was they just were really unrelenting in their philosophy of jail, no bail. We're going to fill the jails. We're going to bring these, police departments and sheriff's departments to a standstill. We're not going to take bail. We're going to remain in jail. Even if they send us to prison, we are going to stay there. And that was part of their victory. Fast forward the next year, SNCC says we're going down to Albany, Georgia. There's a good local campaign there. We're going to get involved in that. Lori Pritchett was looking at how the Freedom Rides played out, but he also did things like he claimed he bragged about reading Gandhi and reading about the tactics of nonviolence that people like Dr. King were reading up on. And he said, you know what, I'm going to learn those tactics because I'm going to learn how to defeat this movement. And the big thing he did was he said, we're not going to let them fill up our jails. We in Albany are going to make, agreements with all of these surrounding counties, and we're just going to arrest people nonstop. And then we're going to send them out to these county jails so that they're not going to be able to fill up 10 jails. And by the way, some of these rural counties he was sending them out to were just notorious. Bad Baker County was one of them. And
Terrible Tom or something like that.
Terrible Terrell, good
Ter
memory.
terrible Terrell, yes.
Yeah. He basically outsourced the arrests and he outsourced some of the violence. And some of these places really brutalized folks in the cells. But what he did was he was very careful to not be caught, not have his men be caught doing any physical violence, any brutality against folks in Albany. And he was very, like you said, smiling. He was considerate. He was polite. One of the most notorious things that happened was Dr. King came down and Ralph David Abernathy came down. They got arrested. They were not going to leave jail. And then they got bailed out. And two of them said, who in the world bailed us out? And they said, oh, it was an anonymous benefactor. He didn't want to be identified. He didn't want you to be in suffering in jail. And they said, oh no, we don't, we want to stay in jail. And then, Pritchett said, oh no, we don't want you to have to endure that. You should leave. Years later, it came out that not only did Pritchett set that up, but Pritchett did that in conversation with some of the members of the U.S. Department of Justice. And there was a connection to the Kennedy administration there. And the benefit for Pritchett was we get Dr. King out of jail. The media is less interested. King can't claim to be a victim if he's not in jail for 2 weeks. And from the Kennedy side, it was like, man, all these civil rights protests are just a big headache. I wish they would go away. So Pritchett was very tactical. The New York Times called him the man of the week. They made him their man of the week. And even later in 63, when Bull Connor just, went totally berserk against Black children and Black protesters, the Birmingham police, Pritchett volunteered his services to Bull Connor and said, hey, you're embarrassing yourself. You're not going to win. Why don't you let me kind of consult with you and advise you on how to actually beat a civil rights campaign? And Bull Connor wasn't interested, but
The f upshot is that Pritchett's playbook became the dominant playbook for dealing with the civil rights movement, not Bull Connor's. There were very few police departments who were going to just unapologetically brutalize, beat, attack with dogs, black children on national television. There were many more who were going to do what Pritchett did. Combination of slow violence, legal tactics, let's keep it quiet, let's work with other counties and jurisdictions, bit of surveillance. Let's do things that are boring to the media. And so then they don't come around and make this a national story.
I think what's crazy is that he studied King, in Eyes on the Prize. He said, "Oh yeah, I studied Dr. King," and he prided himself on understanding and then being able to adapt and move on. And it's something that, if there's a lesson to learn, is that law enforcement is constantly, through their surveillance, adapting and changing tactics. And those who are dealing with them better be on the same page as well on the amount of surveillance that they were doing. If we modernize it today, I mean, we've heard about Black Lives Matter, which you talk about, being under constant surveillance and their chapters around the country. We know that, these police are on social media and sparking up things over and over again. And so it's just very interesting to see how they've been able to play the game and use some of the same things. Will economically cripple you, will come up with new laws to, like the Smith Act that you talked about in the beginning with the communism. I guess what would be the equivalent today? Is it some sort of insurrection act that they're trying to use to go after Antifa? So, finding these laws and then saying, yeah, Dave is talking to Joshua. Joshua had lunch with a guy who was associated with Antifa, and therefore all three of them are connected. Let's send them all to jail. I mean, that's the game that they're playing now, which leads to my other question. You talk a lot about collusion. You mentioned Bull Connor. You talk about the work that police were doing with, back in the heyday, with segregationists, in particular in Birmingham, which leads to the question about Fred Shuttlesworth, and they used to call it Bombingham, and all the domestic bombs that were going off. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think we underestimate the collusion that went on then. And the collusion that I think goes on now, police working with Oath Keepers and working with militias. And if folks recall, we did a whole show on some protesters that were killed in New Mexico, right around the time of the George Floyd. And there were militia folks there. There was a militia folk that did one of the killing or something like that. But the police referred to those militias as armed friendlies, right? So that was their thing. Leave them alone. Those are armed friendly. Those are our people. So that was like out in the open type of collusion. But back then, working with the White Citizens Council and all these organizations. Let's talk a little bit about this collusion, because that seemed to be part of the playbook and a big part of undermining.
Yeah, collusion was really important for me to talk about because one of the myths around resistance to the civil rights movement is really emphasizing vigilante attacks, lone nuts or the Klan or the White Citizens Council. And far too often, we don't acknowledge that they had direct links to police. So, for example, in the Freedom Rides, there were these mobs of angry whites who just kind of set upon the freedom riders like they were, these mobs were like acting like rabid dogs, and they beat the hell out of them in a number of instances in Alabama. And notoriously, for example, in Birmingham, it was Mother's Day, and the Freedom Riders showed up at the station, and they were really kind of taken aback by how it was just really quiet around there. And there were no police who didn't, they didn't show up for like 10, 15 minutes. And these white mobs just kind of, it was open season attacking folks. And, the Freedom Riders, a lot of them had said, we kind of wondered about the police, why they weren't there. One thing that I found in my research that virtually no historian has written about was in 1962, a year after the Freedom Rides, CORE set up this thing called what was it? It was called the Committee to Inquiry into the Administration of Justice in the South. And basically, they set up a tribunal. It's this incredible lineup. It's folks like, pioneering black psychologist Kenneth Clark, whose testimony was so critical for the Brown versus Board of Education case. It was head of the Socialist Party, Norman Thomas. And it was former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt who sat on this committee, other folks. And they said, we need to look into whether law enforcement in the South are colluding with, interacting with, planning any of these things. And in a number of instances, they said, this is very strongly indicative of collusion between state officials and the Klan, state officials and vigilantes. And they were really trying to make a national story out of it. They're really trying to generate press through this kind of commission. And almost universally, the press ignored them. Eleanor Roosevelt was like, she died like a few months later. She was really, really sick. And in her diary, she wrote, this is one of the toughest things I've ever experienced. How little people were interested in our work here, how little people wanted to admit and acknowledge that these are members of the state who are helping the Klan and White Citizens Council carry out this violence. There was a federal judge even who pointed to police in Alabama saying, you guys communicated about this stuff and you neglected your duty and found them negligent on their duty. So it's like that happened again and again in the civil rights movement.
Well, you say in the book that undercover cops were on the freedom buses with folks and pretty much kind of, on one hand, I think there's one scene you describe like they try to keep the mob off the bus. And then on the other scene, they're just standing by and letting them get, pummeled. So, but I don't know whatever happened to those undercover cops. I mean, you named them, did they testify? Did they help bring about justice, or were they just kind of, allowed to go float off in the wind and become footnotes? Because most of us never knew that they were on the bus there with folks.
Yeah, one of the buses had two different undercover Georgia State police officers who were surveilling them. And that was the bus that I think rolled into Anniston, Alabama, where it was set on fire. And the mob literally tried to trap the Freedom Riders inside the bus. And, what I will say about those state police, in that instance, they did probably prevent those Freedom Riders from getting killed. But they didn't do anything else. So it's like, okay, good. One of those police officers shot a gun in the bus to get the mob off the door so that people could get out and not get burned alive. But it's like they didn't make arrests. They didn't investigate any of the mobs. They were there strictly to watch the Freedom Riders, not to do their legal duty. To
Watch like to surveil, collect information.
And I don't think that that came out until later. It's a good question, whatever happened to those guys, but I don't think they ever had to testify. I don't think that they ever, I never saw any evidence anywhere that anything came of them. It's kind of like later, years later, those documents came out and it was proven, oh, okay, well, they were on one of those buses. It's good that they stopped people from getting killed, but otherwise they did nothing. It's kind of like they didn't try to see who the mobs were, didn't take their names or their license plates. It was only to watch the Freedom Riders, not the mobs.
Joshua Davis, I know your time is short, but I have to ask you, and this is, I think, a key part of the book, the resistance and the things that were hidden, primarily, I guess, because it made tactical sense as a strategy not to show that people were willing to go chest to chest, and you showing pictures and giving the behind the scenes story about the picture, and also illuminating Fred Shuttlesworth, who was part of the Big Six. I never knew his get down, like Let's start off with him and then talk about these kids and the pitchers and how they got manipulated. But Fred Shuttlesworth, man, they need a movie on him and his courage and his whole, armed guards and going up against the police and being unafraid against Bull Connor, I think is definitely underreported.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I was just blown away what I learned about him. I mean, his name is on the airport in Birmingham. He's a local hero there, but he's not remembered 1/100th as much as Dr. King nationally. He was part of the SCLC. He was a Baptist minister, but he was probably the most radical guy in that group. And in some ways, it was kind of the wrong group for him because he really was kind of like someone who probably should have been an elder figure in SNCC. He did go to SNCC's founding conference, but I think, in 1963, for example, when King ended up settling with the local Birmingham authorities to reopen basically to desegregate the downtown stores, Shuttleworth famously kind of called out King and said, "You're compromising too soon. We've got to keep protesting. We've got to keep fighting." But what blew me away about Shuttlesworth is that he is challenging Birmingham's police even before the Montgomery bus boycott. He is demanding, for example, that they hire black officers. And yet, today people can argue about what the effectiveness of that is, but we're talking about like all white segregated police departments. And he's identifying that as, not only morally wrong, but like, hey, this is part of why we're getting killed out here. But he and some of his folks around him, around his church, and around his organization, they start catching police, surveilling them, spying on them, sound trucks, police coming into meetings, watching them. It's not just to gather information, it's obviously to intimidate, also to scare, to keep people away from the meetings. It was the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights, I think is what it was called. And in 1959, 1960, Fred Shuttlesworth files a federal suit against Bull Connor in US court and says, "You guys are spying on us. You're violating our civil rights. You're violating our First Amendment rights. We're taking you to court." He defends himself pro se. He doesn't really have a lawyer. He's getting some advice from some civil rights lawyers. But they go to court and he puts Bull Connor on the stand and he interrogates Bull Connor, who is overseeing an all-white police department in Birmingham, Alabama in 1960. That's 3 years before those attacks on black school children in 63. And, they don't win that case, but it's Shuttlesworth is just fearless in
Well, they
confronting
don't
the
win it
police.
because they don't win it because of the collusion with the judge. Yeah,
Yeah, there's
right.
some friendly relations there.
Yeah.
And, Shuttlesworth just always, he's kind of like Ella Baker. He's older than a lot of the young folks in the civil rights movement, but he's in conversations with radicals, with socialists, with this group called SCEF, which was the Southern Conference Education Fund, I think. He is open to radical ideas and he's having thoughts about fighting police violence, both physical and technological, before it's even occurring to most civil rights activists.
What stood out to me is that his house gets bombed. He confronts them with that, but he has armed guards with him everywhere he goes. He's like, yeah, these are my people. They're here to protect me. And what I'm getting from that is that there was a fearlessness. It's like, nah, you're not taking out Fred. And he's the one that's like dispatching people. But to your point with Bull Connor, there's the famous thing that you talked about, where he's basically like, I think you all had something to do with this. And Bull Connor's like, yeah, well, maybe you had something to do with bombing your own house and you should take a lie detector test. And there's a battle of lie detectors and Fred is willing to do it, but Bull never does. And so just his fearlessness against Bull Connor. And I didn't realize his people around him were, openly carrying and like, we'll shoot back if you roll on us. And so that to me was like, I didn't know if SCLC was doing that. But this leads to, since we're talking about Alabama, we'll close out with the kids and the manipulation of pitchers and how these young people were pretty bold in going up against the police and not afraid. But there were some famous pitchers that were manipulated and didn't tell the whole story, but you do in the book.
Yeah, I think The picture on my cover, if that's the picture you're talking about, or
The one with Gadsden, the 15-year-old.
yes, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So this absolutely notorious, world famous picture that appeared on newspapers all over the country on the front page. It was, I believe, 16-year-old Walter Gadsden. He is being attacked by a German Shepherd, held by Birmingham police officer Dick Middleton. This was in May 1963, and it shocked the world. It was like, okay, these cops are treating kids like Nazis. We didn't know they were attacking them with dogs. At least a lot of folks in the country, at least, a lot of white people and a lot of white liberals were like, oh, we didn't know this was happening down there. And in a sense, it was kind of like the George Floyd video. I mean,
Yeah.
Walter Gadsden was not killed, but that image, I mean, it went worldwide. It was picked up by all the European papers, the communist papers, Pravda. They loved it because, hey, look at American hypocrisy. And that picture created this myth of the nonviolent civil rights saint who just endures violence without resisting it. And it's complicated because Dr. King and the SCLC understood the political benefits of that myth. They understood that most white folks were not going to sympathize with the civil rights movement unless they saw civil rights activists as basically like harmless, almost childlike, peaceful, willing to endure just ungodly amounts of violence for the larger cause. That picture was reproduced around the country, grainy black and white newspaper covers. And if you look at a high resolution image, you see a few things that was missed by most people. First, you notice that Walter Gadsden is hard as hell gripping the arm of Dick Middleton and trying to pull him off of him. And second, you'll notice that his knee is raised and he is kneeing that German Shepherd under his jaw. And that's a technique that he had learned from his father, who taught him how to handle dogs. And that's how you stop a dog who's biting you, is you try to slam its jaw shut. Almost no one commented on that. Almost no one noticed that, okay, this kid actually is resisting. He is fighting back. He's not just laying down and taking this. And
And you described him as somebody who wasn't a part of any training. He just came out because he saw a protest and they attacked him. So he
yeah.
wasn't like part of the cadre of people to go protest that day.
Exactly. And he took that story to Jet Magazine a few months later. The story, the picture I have on the cover of my book is from that exact same day in Birmingham in May 1963. And it's a totally different picture that's much less famous. It did appear in Life magazine, and Life magazine said, oh, this is a crowd of black youth jeering a police officer.
Yeah.
This is like, risking starting a riot. But it is a group of black teenagers surrounding a white cop. The white cop is leaning back. He's got a billy club, but you can tell he's nervous. He's scared. He doesn't have all his guys around him. These kids are not going to hurt this cop at all. But when you look into their faces, they are laughing at the cop. They are yelling at the cop. They are pointing at him. You don't know exactly what they're thinking. But what comes across is they are saying, we see you, we are on to you, we are not scared of you, we will not take this. And he looks terrified. And
Yeah.
again, they're not threatening violence. They're just saying, there's more of us than you, and we're laughing at you because you're terrorizing us and you can't get away with this with impunity. That was the picture I wanted to put on my book
Yeah.
because that was the picture of folks fighting back against police violence that most, folks in the civil rights movement maybe were not comfortable being front page news.
But you also point out in that chapter where you talk about it, because as you said, it's the same day that when a batch of pitchers is sent, when they do run the pitcher, they remove the billy club from the cop. So it gives the kids, it makes it look like a very nefarious thing, going against the police when in fact it was the police that were attacking all that day and the kids stood up.
Yeah, I
You
believe it
know,
was cropped in a way that
it
you
was
couldn't
cropped.
see it. Yeah, and it was a little picture in Life magazine. I mean, at the time, Life magazine was like one of the top 10 most popular magazines in the country. So it still got eyeballs, but it was like this little picture at the end of a long photo spread. And it was one of the few pictures that life carried that had a caption that was kind of disapproving of the protesters. You know, here's black kids acting bad. They're jeering this cop. They might set off a riot. And yeah, if you look at the full picture, it's pretty different.
You know, as we close out, anything you want us to, or any big surprises that you came across that we didn't talk about that you want people to pay extra attention to with this excellent book you did.
Yeah, I think the big thing about Police Against the Movement, I just want people to remember is one, civil rights activists, it was not all kumbaya, were laying down. They were resisting police violence. They did see police violence as physical, legal, technological. And it wasn't just the FBI, the feds, and Hoover that are doing the sophisticated disruption of movements. The local police and their red squads are doing it even before them. In some ways, they're doing it in more extreme ways. And if we bring those red squads back into the civil rights story, and we bring the activists who fought police violence back into the civil rights story, the civil rights movement looks different because this myth that basically they left this issue untouched for decades and left it only to the Panthers and later BLM to pick up is really a misreading of the civil rights movement, at least its radical wing. Not everyone in the movement was doing this, but folks like SNCC and CoR were. So the movement looks different and state repression looks different if we, you know, tell the story that I'm trying to tell in Police Against the Movement.
We didn't really get into what was happening out west and what was going on in the northern cities. So this surveillance and undermining is widespread, you know, all the way up to Oakland and LA, hiring cops from the south to come police their communities, all the way up to the surveillance of modern, resistance against police. So there's a lot to cover. But just the chapters about the civil rights movement, it definitely gives you a different a wider lens to look at this through. And shame on anybody who would say this civil rights with this ain't your grandfather and your grandmother's civil rights movement. You know, my grandfather and grandmother like Fred Shuttlesworth and some of those folks you describe. You know, then I have a lot of footsteps to live up to, you know, not the other way around, because it was about that life in ways that I think we should have a deeper appreciation for. We appreciate you, Joshua Davis, for bringing this information to us, for penning this book. It's definitely something that we should have in our archives, and you know, we'll see in the whirlwind if you know as Marcus Garvey would say.
Thanks so much for having me, Davey. I appreciate it.
No doubt. Ralph for now. Peace.